This is episode 186, recorded November 18th, 2013.
Greetings, Aquariumaxers.
Hello.
We are about to unveil, release, disseminate some important information.
It's kind of exciting.
It's very exciting. We have officially
reached enough money to buy
the field recorder and the power supply.
So they are ordered and on their way.
Yeah, so we may have one more week without it that we need to record, but after that we should be set. And if we're lucky, we'll be recording next week with the field recorder. Yay!
It's kind of exciting. So again, gigantic thank you to everybody who donated.
Yeah, can we go through them
again? Yes, yes. We have a list here of everybody, and we're going to thank you again because you're awesome. So we've got Steve in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Tom in Provo, Utah, and Chris in New Hampshire, and David in Colorado, Sean in Asheville, North Carolina, Dr. Bob in Boston, North Shore, and Henry in Switzerland.
Yep. And the last two just donated within the last week.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you to everybody. In the last
couple days. Yes. Big, yeah. Big thank you. So, shall we proceed?
Yeah.
Okay. And we actually have something from Sean in North Carolina this week. And he says, there's an issue to consider if changing from 250-watt to 1 300-watt heaters. So that we were...
Talking about Dr. Bob... Not Dr. Bob. Matt in Perth, Western Australia, was thinking about saving some energy in his aquarium.
That's right. He says the issue to consider would be the risk of the heater failing on or failing off. Twice the heat if the 300 watt fails on, or no heat versus half the heat if it fails off.
Right. And that is
kind of all your heat in one basket.
Yeah. And that is one of the reasons why people will often do two smaller heaters rather than one big one, for the reason that Sean cites. So that's a good point to bring up. Sort of a safety feature.
Yep. Okay, he says, my guess is there's a marginal amount of additional power required to run 250 watts versus 1 300-watt.
Yeah, okay.
He also says he's on our side of the country now in Las Vegas for a conference.
Which he may not be by now, but he was.
He was when he sent it.
Yep.
So enjoy Vegas, if that's possible. Not my favorite place. Okay, so thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
And now we have Robert.
This is Robert from Facebook.
Robert from Facebook, Cyber Robert.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's talking about that same problem. He says, I'm trying to answer the question you asked about saving on electricity. In short, unless you are paying some huge amount per kilowatt hour or using some high wattage lighting, look elsewhere. Without getting into a lesson in basic electronics and a bit of math, a 15-watt air pump costs about 50 cents a month to run and 25 cents in
US dollars. 24/7.
I was thinking, wow, he runs it extra. 24/7 at 15 cents per kilowatt hour. I don't know what it is in Australia.
No, but if we are saying this in US dollars, then it's easy enough to convert.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't know what Matt rates are in Australia.
No, I don't know either. Yeah.
No. It says, turning off your typical air pump to save money is a waste of time. I have 3 10-gallon aquariums and 1 2.5-gallon, 3 air pumps, 3 7-watt T5 fluorescent light fixtures, 1 LED light fixture, and 3 hang-on-the-back filters. The lights are on 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, and all of the tanks are planted. I'm not including heaters because they are off probably 90% of the time, and without actually measuring their usage over an extended period, at least a year, it's not much of an expenditure. You are not going to turn off your aquarium heater to save power anyway. All of this equipment uses about 100 watts. At 15 cents per kilowatt hour, it costs 1.5 cents per hour to run. The lights cost $1.95 a month. Air pumps and filters cost $7.56 a month. Total cost is $9.51 a month, not counting the heaters, which I doubt would add more than a dollar a month. I could save some by switching to LED lighting, but the amount would be so small that recovering the cost of the light would take years. If you are running modern fluorescent lighting, you are going to have a hard time justifying the cost of switching to LED. Some like to say that you get some money back in bulbs. In my case, this is a very small amount since I use 6,800K bulbs I buy from eBay for less than a dollar each. If I swap them out twice a year, they still cost me only $6 a year. By the way, all of these aquariums are planted. We should look into light bulbs on eBay.
Yeah.
Is that including shipping? Less than a dollar each with shipping? Because it's expensive to ship light bulbs.
It can be, so that's good to look into, yeah.
So, Robert, send us a link with your person that you buy these from.
And he said they were T5s, right?
I think so. 6,800K.
But, I mean, yeah, the 6,800K, but...
Earlier he says yes, T5.
Yeah, T5s.
Yeah.
Okay.
When you were talking about aquariums that were... people don't do water changes, I think you forgot to mention Wallstatt aquariums. I thought you might like to hear about mine.
Maybe we did. I don't know.
I think we did. We weren't thinking about that at the time.
Mm-hmm. After having had Diana on the show twice.
what were we thinking?
Should have thought of that.
Yeah. He says, I have four aquariums that haven't had a water change for several years. I replace evaporated water with rainwater I collect from my roof. I only replace water that gets removed when filters are cleaned or through some other maintenance task. I have guppies, various corys, otters, white clouds, zebra danios, and a school of neons. There are several mystery snails and a ton of Malaysian trumpet snails as well. I keep ammonia sensors in all the aquariums, and the only ammonia spike I've had is when a very large snail died in the 2.5 gallon. I have 3 10-gallon tanks, each set up a little differently. They all have black diamond substrate on top. 1 10-gallon has only black diamond blasting grit. One had black diamond blasting grit on top of shredded oak leaf mold, and the 3rd 10-gallon has black diamond blasting grit on top of compost. The 4th aquarium is a 2.5 gallon with only 1/4 inch of gravel in the bottom. The 10 gallons have a very heavy bio load, but the sponge and the hang-on back filters keep up with it very well. All of the tanks are heavily planted. Planted, not aquascaped, unless jungle is an aquascape.
I have an example right over there, don't I?
I remove plants at least once a week, sometimes more, depending on how much is growing. I have various crypts, dwarf Sagittarius, frogbit, duckweed, Java fern, Java moss, corkscrew val, anubias, and a few mystery plants I haven't identified yet. The plants are the big difference. For example, I have one aquarium where Java moss will not grow, and another where it grows so much it gets to be annoying by getting tangled up in everything. Java fern does very well in this same aquarium. I can only get anubias to grow in one of the aquariums. Dwarf Sagittarius runs wild in two of them, but barely stays alive in the aquarium where the Java moss and ferns grow great. The crypts do well in all of the 10-gallon aquariums, but being crypts, they grow slowly. I don't have to remove any crypts. This all started as an experiment to see if there was anything to this Wallstatt aquarium thing. I was especially attracted to the lower maintenance aspects of it. Not logging buckets of water around all the time was very attractive, although I still have to carry some. If anyone has questions, feel free to ask. I might be slow to respond because I'm very busy right now and don't usually hang out on Facebook.
That's cool. That's, you know, a demonstration of basically the Wallstatt method with his own, you know, variations on the theme.
I hope Diana's listening to this. I don't know if she listens to us or not. But.
Well, he's definitely got, some of those principles at work there. It's obvious that it's working for him, so that's cool. And I really wish we would have mentioned that before, but I guess we're mentioning it now, so thank you for bringing it up, Robert.
That was great. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have one more. We have a communique from Dr. Bob, but I do not promise to be able to read all of it because our printer was failing.
Oh, I think that part is just my notes at the bottom.
Oh, okay, so you can go over that part.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Dr. Bob says, on the topic of frequent water changes, I also have no problem accepting the hypothesis that frequent large water changes are beneficial to the fish. Natural environments, depending on the size of the body of water, transport the waste away at nearly 100%. I would, however, appreciate a study that shows a benefit analysis of different aquarium water change amounts and cycles. My hypothesis is that we would see a diminishing benefit as we approach the upper limits of amounts and cycles. I agree with Russ when he said that our empirical evidence is the large body of evidence that shows moderate cycles with moderate amounts yield healthy fish that live long lives and spawn readily.
I like that idea. I think it makes sense that you'd get diminishing returns with the higher changeover rates of the water, and it would be interesting to see You know, because if you have fish that are thriving it with, say, I don't know, 40% water changes, then...
In response to Sean's question about...
You know, they seem to be performing maximally, then how much better can they do at 80% water changes? I think that makes a lot of sense. It would be interesting to see that. Yeah, it would be interesting to see that. Somebody ought to do that. Causing
pain, thus the name, but also in the lug's heart and brain. Bubbles in the blood cause blockages that can lead to damage to organ tissue and even death. Whether or not the lack of outgassing would cause the bends in fish is unclear, but it is always safer to allow the water time to outgas.
Okay, so we were pretty much on track with that, though.
So, this is probably a goofy question on my part, but I'm good at those, so I'm going to ask it anyways. So this kind of, is Dr. Bob like an actual doctor or a PhD doctor, or, well, I shouldn't say actual doctor, a medical doctor then? He sounds like a medical doctor.
He is a doctor. He a
PhD doctor, or I guess that can be the same thing, huh?
I can't remember if he's a medical doctor, but I sort of got that impression.
Okay.
He is a doctor, but he doesn't play one on TV, remember?
Right! There we go. Okay. Okay. In response to Matt's question about reducing power consumption, the general rule of thumb is that a single 300-watt device is more efficient than two 150-watt devices. The best solution would be a single more powerful canister filter with the heater built in. The kilowatt power meter will help as it... Sorry, my notes are a little streaky, so I'm trying to make sure I read it right. Power meter will help as it provides a means to measure watts used over time intervals. It works well for all continuous use devices. Filters and pumps would fall into this category. If lights are on timers, then their wattage could be used based upon the hours per day of use. The heaters are the variable that would be harder to calculate since their use is dependent on the ambient air temperature. If the room temperature is kept consistently at one temperature, then you will get an accurate idea of the heater watt usage over the course of an hour or day. If, however, the room temperature fluctuates with the time of day and according to seasons, then you need to expect that heating costs would increase in the winter and decrease in the summer. The kilowatt meter would still be useful as you would get at least ballpark numbers. And when I'm saying kilowatt meter that he's talking about, it's capitalized and it's K-I-L-L-A-W-A-T-T. Like it's a...
Yeah, it's a proprietary name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though it sounds very similar to kilowatt with K-I-L-O. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the play on words is intentional.
Play on words are never intentional. What are you talking about? I've never known you to ever, ever in your life use a pun.
Really?
No, I'm totally joking.
Okay. You just got some sarcasm on my sleeve.
I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. He says, one idea to reduce heating costs is to insulate the tank. Typically, the back and bottom of a tank is not used to view, so fitting a piece of styrofoam to cover those sides would reduce the amount of heat loss through the glass. If the tank is acrylic, then your heat loss is much lower than glass, but it would benefit from insulation as well. For the back, I put the background paper on first and then apply the styrofoam sheeting with clear packing tape. You could do one or both of the sides, especially if you have a built-in unit.
Yeah, so you have, like, your tank is recessed, so you're not going to see the sides anyway, and it would be easy to do that. Yeah, that's a good, very good insulator, so that makes a lot of sense. I think we talked about, a long time ago, talked about doing that when you had a power outage, but...
Oh, that sounds vaguely familiar.
When you just want to save heat, you can just do that even if you don't, so that might be a good way for Matt to save some heat.
Insulating his house.
Just insulate the whole tank. Yeah. Makes sense. Okay. Oh, yeah. This one I have read, and Kelly has not read it yet, and the printer is having a big problem with it, so I'm going to read it.
Summarize.
Okay. Basically, he said, Dr. Bob said he seems to be having a problem with what he thinks is a bacterial infection in some of his fish. The recent acquisitions, the symptoms are a fuzzy white substance on the nose and mouth of the fish, and, oh, wow, this is really... toasted, isn't it? But he was thinking, I needed to quarantine the fish. He was thinking that would be the best line of defense, but also thought about using Mellifix.
And what's Mellifix?
Mellifix is a tea tree oil-based medication. Yeah. Okay. It's based on Melaleuca alternifolia, I think, is the species they use. And it's an Australian tea tree extract, an oil that comes from that. And he's wondering if that's going to be a problem for his cycling, basically.
To use the medicine?
Right, because the Malefix is, it's sold, and it is, one of its features are that it's not supposed to damage filter cycles, you know, your beneficial bacteria. It's not supposed to be a problem for them. But he's wondering if that is indeed the case.
Have we ever used
it? These fish. And I've used it a couple of times in the past. It's been, you know, a few years since I used it. I was never really sure that it did anything. Mm-hmm. I can't really say one way or the other. You know, I haven't done extensive testing with it or anything, so I can't really say. I have used it, but I really couldn't tell you if it's a good thing or a bad thing or whatever. It's a really controversial sort of product.
Really?
Yeah. There are a lot of people out there who say it does damage the filter, and there are a lot of people out there who say, no, it doesn't, and there are plenty of people who say, oh, this really helps my fish, and other people who say, this is worthless.
I just had a really funny image in my head. Yeah. It was a little tangent when you said it was really controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Like a fish daytime talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottle of the Malefix, like, sitting there on the chair and all the audience members yelling at it. Sorry.
Because of all the controversy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
that was weird.
Really, it's there are a lot of strong feelings out there online about whether or not it should be used and whether or not it actually does anything.
Well, do you think from the fish's symptoms that it's something that would benefit from the heater getting turned up?
It's very hard to tell, really. I would say that, you know, with it having something fungus-like around the mouth, it is very likely, as Dr. Bob says, that it could be a fungal infection. I mean, a bacterial infection rather than a fungal infection. That's what I mean. Even though it might look fungal, often true, what appear to be fungal infections in fish are often, very often bacterial.
Mm.
And they can be pretty dangerous. I mean, if it's growing around the mouth, it could be columnaris, which is pretty scary stuff, but it's not necessarily that. There's so many things it could be. There are some viruses that'll have symptoms like that, where they just sort of get a cauliflower-like growth around, and it can be around the mouth or other parts of the body, and it's usually not very threatening, and it often will just spontaneously disappear if it's if it's that kind of virus. It can also be a very fast-spreading bacteria like columnaris. It can be true fungus on occasion, but that usually happens when the fish has already been damaged, and it's sort of a an opportunistic thing that the fungus won't attack a healthy fish, but if there's a wounded fish, it will sometimes attack. So it's hard to tell. One thing I would say is just if you can get pictures of the fish, and you maybe can send us some, you might try posting it on wet web media because they're often pretty good at diagnosing such things. I have dealt with a few things of that sort, but I wouldn't be confident that I could get a correct diagnosis. You know, and you can't really, unless you get a scraping and you put it under a microscope and all that stuff. But,
which is,
you know, sometimes difficult. You can, yeah, it's difficult to do, but, it would be worth a shot. I remember I did have in Hawaii, so it's been quite a while now, I had some neons that had a sort of a fungusy looking thing that we think is probably bacterial. And all I had to do was move them to a warmer tank. And as soon as I did that, it disappeared within a couple of days, and they were all happy and healthy. And it disappeared completely, even though it was a pretty scary-looking kind of thing going on. So, and I posted that to Wet Web Media and said, here are my possibilities. I'm thinking of moving these fish. What do you think? And they said, yes, do it. And I did it, and there you go. Really. Yep, went away. So,
what about the salt thing?
Oh, yes. And he also asked about salt. He's saying that some places say that salt is, I mean, there's aquarium salt and there's Epsom salts, and different people are prescribing them for different things. And I have used aquarium salt to treat fish for various things. I have not used Epsom salts to do that. But I looked up, again, on Wet Web Media, because I think they have some good information there, the differences and when you should use one, and the general idea, and we'll put a link on the show page so you can look up this kind of little blurb on it, if you want to call it a blurb. I don't know what you call it. An article would be a better word, I suppose, for different types of salt, aquarium salts and Epsom salts, and when to use them. And the upshot was basically that Epsom salts are good for treating anything that involves the need to get muscles more relaxed. Okay, so that can be anything, even like constipation, for fish constipation, it can be helpful. It can be good for things like swelling. So dropsy, it can help treat dropsy.
Interesting.
At least treat the symptom. It may not treat the underlying cause, but it can be good for that.
Make them more
comfortable, though. Mm-hmm. And things of that nature. The aquarium salt was more for things like external parasites and anything from leeches to ick to, you know, other gill flukes, things like that. Of course, the salt can also be good for osmotic, lowering osmotic stress on fish. And for, it can help reduce toxicity of certain waste products like nitrites and nitrates and things like that. It did mention that salt has been used to treat fungus, but it's not the best at doing that. And
about bacterial infections.
And I know it's been used to treat bacterial infections as well,
but you just don't really know which one it is.
Yeah, and there are some broad spectrum antibiotics that are sometimes better for the bacteria.
Are those just at the pet store?
There are many of them that are available at pet stores. Of course, the best thing is to take it to a fish vet, but not everybody can do that,
and it's quite expensive to do. Fish. I don't know if they're already ill. They probably wouldn't survive a trip to the vet.
Well, it depends on how sick they are. But, yeah, I would say if posting it, you know, posting the pictures to Whitman, I mean, it might be a useful thing to do. I would hope so. That would be possible. And, you know, I hope that was some helpful information.
Hopefully they get better.
Yeah, I hope so. And, are these your fish in your 55, your native fish, or are these some other fish? Because, you know, knowing what species it are and what other conditions they're in, what temperature they're in and so on, could shed some light on the subject. Because some of these things are related to temperature, water quality, and that sort of thing. So, anything else?
I think that's everything.
Okay. Well, I hope we didn't miss anybody today. Sometimes I end up missing somebody, and it's always by accident. But
if we did, we'll get you next week.
Yeah, we'll try to do that. So once again, thank you to all our contributors and all of our those who donated. And we'll be looking forward to recording with improved equipment very soon.
And the Living Planet Aquarium here in Salt Lake should be open within a few months.
Their new facility should be opening in December.
Yeah, I will be surprised if they actually open in December. Nothing ever opens when it says it's going to open.
We'll see how it goes. But they'll be opening soon, and we will be looking to do an interview there.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, so. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen.
May the fish
be with you.